Hey, welcome to Blue Wire. After you finish listening to this awesome Blue Wire podcast, make sure you check out the other pods in our Blue Wire family. Okay, I know, you're probably wondering, how do I do that? Well, it's simple. Go to iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and search Blue Wire. Ta-da! They will all be there, so have fun listening.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectacularario, is either adjusting his office chair at the moment or murdering a row of rubber ducks co-host Andrew D. Bailey.
I hope that doesn't come through too loudly, but yes, it was the chair. Rest easy, Hardwood Knox listeners.
Okay, good. We don't support the mutilation of rubber ducks on this podcast. Before we get started, I just want to remind, implore, beg, plead with everyone to continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. We are wherever else you get your podcasts: Stitcher, Blog Talk Radio, Google Play, Art19, we are all over the place, Spotify, but iTunes is the best way to let us know that you're out there, that you're listening. We've read the recent reviews. We would appreciate those. Keep coming in. Throw us some five-star ratings. If you have not subscribed and you are listening to this podcast, I don't even know how that works, but just subscribe. If you've done all those things, referrals, steal people's phones, subscribe them to us. They will thank you later. And I'll start plugging this at the beginning. Please remember to follow Blue Wire on Twitter at Blue Wire Pods. Also remember to follow Andy on Twitter at Andrew D. Bailey. I can be found at Dan Favalli. Today we have the first part of our, we're going to make this an annual thing since the first time we did it was last year, our ranking of the top 25 lineups. We'll get into the mostly objective criteria in a second, but first I really just wanted to ask that question that everyone needs to know. Andy, how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm ready to talk about some lineups. This will be the fun part of my day because later in the morning I've got a client that's trying to get a restraining order put on him. So that'll be fun.
Trying to get a restraining order put on himself?
No. the way I said that, it could sound like that. But I'm trying to help a client avoid a restraining order. Would have been a better way of phrasing it. So this will be a nice. This will be a nice departure from the rest of the day, that's for sure.
I think we should just clarify for listeners that the restraining order is not Kawhi Leonard getting one against me for trying to email him about joining the Hawks this summer. I just want to make that clear.
Wouldn't that be funny if he like randomly went somewhere like that or the Kings or something while everybody was like...
If you had to pick just among the, let's say, the top 10 free agents this summer, who would be the most likely to just throw that curveball?
It would probably be him, right?
I would think so, too. I know he's been linked to the Clippers and that the way he exited San Antonio suggests that he cares about clout and maybe market size a little bit. But I would think it would be him. Maybe Kemba Walker. I could see him just being like, is awful. I need to go chase the basketball fit. Although Charlotte's been playing well of late, although it might be a little too late for them.
Too late, yeah. I was just looking at the playoff probabilities on 538 last night, and I don't know why I was expecting Charlotte to be higher, but they're only at like 16%.
I did actually, before we really get to the criteria, since we haven't podcasted since, and since we're a spoiler, not going to get to this team today, although they do make the list at some point. The Jusuf Nurkić injury in Portland.
Oh my gosh, that was rough.
That was I'm one of those people, I don't want to watch those things, but my mind almost forces me to watch it once. I didn't see it live. I was actually letting my dog out when it happened while I was watching that game. I saw at first the replay of the Nets players running away, which was just harrowing, and then I watched it, and it was obviously gruesome. The bigger aspect, though, is that's just a huge... I told you, I texted you, I said, I'm really happy he got paid last summer, because you never want to see this happen, but... Certainly you don't want to see it happen to someone in a contract year, but it was a career year, and that's a devastating loss for them as we look ahead to the playoffs. And not to make it about basketball, but it's absolutely devastating to their playoff stock.
Yeah, he's been huge, and we've talked about it on here that by some measures, he's been number two on that team ahead of CJ McCollum. In fact, I don't think it would be that hard to make the argument that he's their second best player this season. They've trusted him with some facilitation duties, which I always love from big men. He's a lot better defensively than I think a lot of people realize. In terms of his actual injury, I was really happy to hear that there was no structural damage beyond the bone breaks. Like, there was no muscle damage, ligament damage, anything like that. So hopefully it can just be a nice, clean, broken bone recovery, and he'll be back, I don't know, maybe towards the end of next season. But yeah, that as soon as I hear about stuff like that, my first thought, I just feel sick for the player. I've kind of been in that situation. I broke my femur as a sophomore in high school, in a basketball game, and my leg was very deformed looking. and I tore my ACL in college, right before my junior season in college. I've had the get undercut while you're in the air and hurt your back injury. I've kind of run the gamut of basketball injuries. So I just instantly feel bad for the players when that happens. But then, like you, I think I do not want to see that. And then I randomly do on Twitter or something like that. And it's just like, ugh.
Right. I'll never watch it again. I will see
exactly.
These things once.
I saw it one time, and I'm sure this referee has already caught enough flack, and I heard that he reached out to Nurkic and apologized, but the walkover was terrible too.
Yeah, I'm not sure what was – when people called it a kick, seemed a little bit extreme because it didn't look like a kick, but I also –
it was inadvertent.
Right.
But I thought was there's – why are you walking over him regardless of whether or not he's hurt?
Right. I didn't understand that part, but people were like, oh, he kicked him. I was like, by the end of the night, it was like he people's elbowed his injury or something. I didn't see that. But and for Nurkic, I know that there's this prevailing thought it's easier to approximate the value of big men with cheaper options or backup options. But I feel like he fills too many different holes for them for that to really be possible. Like what he does on the glass as a passer, as a screener. It's not like you're just trying to replace this guy who either protects the rim or he's a good rim runner. Like he's doing all these different things. He's been absolute beast on the boards this year. And as you said, the passing as well, making smarter decisions overall. And I don't even think it's really a case that he's bought Portland's second best player this year. I think it's just at this point, it has to be a matter of fact statement.
Did you see my thread the other day about what some stat lines look like if they were played at Wilt Chamberlain's pace?
I did, and it was making NBA Twitter very uneasy.
Yeah. The Yusef Nurkic one, if he played at the pace of the 61-62 season and played as many minutes as Wilt, he'd be averaging 37 points, 25 rebounds, 8 assists, with a true shooting percentage near 60. He's been – I mean, obviously he's not playing that many minutes and they're not playing that fast, but even his regular numbers like you said, he does everything for them. It's really, really unfortunate for the Blazers. Obviously unfortunate for him, but I am glad that he should be able to make a full recovery and hopefully have many, many more successful years after this one.
I'm right there with you. Segueing into the lineups. So our criteria for this was basically objective. What we did was we took possession data from Cleaning the Glass. This is all current as of, we took them after Tuesday's games. So this is what all the rankings will be based off of. And I think there's, when you look at some of the games, yes, it matters maybe for some lineups for the rest of the season, but there gets to be so much noise as we really get closer to April. And you have teams that really aren't trying to win or good teams that are resting guys. We took the number of possessions, multiplied it by net rating, and then divided that number by 100 just because we don't want to say these large-ass numbers. For their lineup score. Not a perfect science, but it was just meant to reward results and volume. What we also did is we then removed any lineups that can no longer be played if players were traded. This time, and I think we did this last time too, we did leave in players that are injured. So a lineup that includes, which is what we're going to get kicked off with, a lineup that includes Victor Oladipo was fair game to make this list because he's still on the Pacers. And so I think that's a fair delineation. Are you ready to get into this, Andy?
Let's do it.
Our first lineup, as I hinted at, comes from the Indiana Pacers. Their lineup score is 58.83. They've played, here's the lineup. We should do that first. Darren Collison, Victor Oladipo, Bojan Bogdanovic, Thaddeus Young, and Miles Turner. They've played 1,110 possessions together. They have a net rating of 5.3 for a lineup score of 58.83. This is not an inclusion that surprised me at all. It's one that I could actually have seen having climbed higher if Victor Oladipo never gets injured.
Absolutely. I don't know. I'm with you. I'm rambling already. I like this lineup a lot. I think Thad Young is a guy who kind of fills the gaps for them. Miles Turner is like the defensive anchor. And I think we've seen how good Bojan Bogdanovic is post Oladipo injury. So having both of them together in a lineup was, it obviously worked really, really well. It's still unfortunate, obviously, that Oladipo went down, because I think the Pacers would be a very good pick to advance past the first round. If they had kind of stayed on this trajectory, like you said, if they had kept playing, they probably would have been higher. I know a lot of people have talked about Doc Rivers as coach of the year. That's probably my pick. Coach Budenholzer obviously deserves a lot of credit there as well, but Nate McMillan should absolutely be in the conversation, because the Pacers have just, I feel like they've exceeded expectations pretty thoroughly each of the last two seasons, and they were well on their way to, possibly even getting home court advantage in the first round if the Oladipo injury doesn't happen.
Yeah, he definitely belongs there. And what I found most interesting about this lineup, they forced turnovers on 17.6% of their possessions, and yet their opponent free throw rate was just insanely low. So it's like you're forcing all those turnovers without committing a ton of fouls. That would have been an interesting lineup to see sort of play out over the course of the season. And both Thaddeus Young and Miles Turner's, Miles Turner definitely isn't going to make it. Maybe Thad Young does, but those are two all defensive candidates this year with the way that they've both defended.
For sure. Miles Turner is almost a lock, I would think.
You don't
well,
think?
Well, actually, yeah. I was thinking there's only two center spots.
Yeah.
Gobert is going to get one of them.
Yes.
Who would compete for the second one with Turner? I'm trying to think.
I think Joel Embiid.
Yeah. I would go with Turner over him, I think. I'm not looking at the numbers, so that's maybe irresponsible of me to just throw that out there. But he's got to be in the top three or four centers. So I guess he's certainly in.
Maybe he is a lock. I don't think he's a lock. I haven't really gone through my all defensive. My all NBA teams are set. We'll eventually have to do a pod on that. Or not set. They're subject to change, but I have a pretty hold on that. The all defensive teams, I feel like they're always a little bit tough, but this year I haven't really, I guess, given it enough thought. But when you go through it, and maybe he even is a lock. There's Joel Embiid, but beyond that.
I should know this already, but do they do the guard, forward, center for defense?
Yeah, they shouldn't. Everything, that stuff needs to be abolished. The All-NBA stuff, they've already done it for the All-Star. I'd like to see them just abolish the center designation. I mean, I guess that hurts bigs in this scenario, but maybe it actually helps them, because then you can have multiple centers that make it if you're just classifying it as front court players.
Yeah, I think some years it would help and some years it would hurt. So I don't know where you would fall on that if you're the NBA.
Already off the rails.
24 is the Detroit Pistons. We actually talked about this one a little bit before we even started recording, but Ish Smith, which I'm not surprised that he's there over Reggie Jackson. Ish Smith, Langston Galloway, Luke Kennard, Blake Griffin, and Andre Drummond. That lineup's only played 127 possessions, which almost seems like malpractice to me.
Oh, excuse me. That was the other thing, is every lineup had to play a minimum of 100 possessions. That just seemed like that's the one that's enough sample size for Cleaning the Glass to give percentile ratings on the lineup samples. So we don't have a lot of terribly small sample size lineups, but 100 possessions was the cutoff. That gave us a sample of like 300-something lineups.
That lineup's net rating is in the 99th percentile. It's plus 47.4.
Seems high.
Yeah. That would certainly come down quite a bit if this lineup was given more possessions together. But I do think this is a lineup that makes a ton of sense. I think before the season started, and maybe even right around the time the Pistons traded for Blake Griffin, we talked about if you're going to have Griffin and Drummond on the floor together, you need to surround it with a bunch of shooting. And I think maybe they've mitigated the non-shooting a little bit just by virtue of the fact that Blake Griffin has become like the volume three-point shooter on the Pistons. I almost couldn't believe my eyes the other day when I was just looking at basic numbers, and he leads the team in three-pointers made. But I always thought the ideal fit for a front court of those two guys was going to be shooters. And Kennard is obviously that. Langston Galloway can shoot. Ish Smith, not as much, but I think with that lineup, with those two guys, specifically Griffin and Drummond, you need as much shooting around them as you can possibly have. And this is one of those lineups that kind of gets close to that.
Can you guess what this lineup is shooting from? I'll give you an over under of 45% from a 3-point range, this lineup when they're on the court.
I'm going to say under.
Over 47.8% from three.
You're getting me with these questions now. I've missed the last couple.
I actually thought you were going to pick the over on this one, because why would I say 45? 45 is astronomically high for any lineup.
I was trying to like think too much about you tricking me. How many attempts have they taken this lineup?
22 of 46. Again,
that's more than I thought, though.
Yeah, it's the sample size is still small, but I mean, Luke Kennard's a good shooter. We knew that. Langston Galloway, I would say for the second half of the season, he's gone through his swings as usual, but he's mostly had these hot stretches. And as you talked about with Blake Griffin, I'm still surprised that this is the lineup. That maybe I'm not surprised, but it's the Pistons season, especially lately. They're tough to get a read on. But again, with the way that Galloway and Kennard have been shooting, maybe it's not so much of a surprise that this lineup's offense is so potent.
Yeah, and they killed the Magic last night. So
that the NBA must, this is off the rails again, but there must be something that goes into projecting these end of season games, like last year with the play-in between the Nuggets and the Timberwolves, and then you look at the final, not even just day of the regular season, but like the week. You have the Hornets playing the Magic and the Pistons, and like yeah. Those are all the teams that are scrapping with one another. There's something that has to go into it.
Palm reading or something. I don't know.
That'd be crazy if that's what it was. Number 23, the 23rd best lineup from the Orlando Magic. I'm just gonna come out and say this, not spoil anything. I was shocked at how many times Orlando popped up in this exercise. The lineup is DJ Augustine, Terrence Ross, Evan Fournier, Aaron Gordon, Nikola Vucevic. They have played 440 possessions together. Their net rating is 13.7 for a lineup score of 60.28. Anytime Vooch or DJ Augustine is on the floor this year, the Magic's offense, and this is the biggest criticism that they received in the offseason, was that they weren't going to be able to generate a league average offense. It has been a monster. When they're together, it has been a monster. Even when they're separate, the lineups have been good. This particular lineup, offensive rating of 118.2, which is just absolutely nutso. And they don't turn the ball over, just a mark of a good coach, Steve Clifford team. If you told me that this is where they ended up, I mean, fine, 23rd, whatever. But the fact that this isn't going to be the last Orlando Magic lineup in here is still just, mind-boggling might be too strong a word, but it's pleasantly surprising. And the other thing I'll add is they've been able to sustain that offensive rating, this lineup, without great three-point shooting. I know this is probably the lineup that has all their best shooters in it. When you look at Terrence Ross, Fournier, and Augustine, but they're only shooting 35.4% from deep, this group, on the season. And so, it's again, to have that, you have Vooch, who's just hyper-efficient. Again, you could probably throw him into their best shooting category. I'm genuinely surprised to see them fall this high.
I think I'm surprised by how many Magic lineups there are. Like you said, I'm not surprised to see a lineup with Vucevic and Augustine. As you laid out, those two guys together has been... They've been really effective all season long. I caught a lot of crap the last time I did my average player rankings on Twitter, because people have finally noticed that Vucevic is in the top 10 even though he's been there for weeks.
I thought it was, maybe it wasn't most of the year. I thought I remembered it being like around the All-Star break that he was in there.
It's been a while. Yeah. So maybe the right person with enough angry followers found it this time, but there was a lot of jokes and whatever. And I get it. Vucevic isn't a guy you think of as a top 10 player. And if I was just, you know, spouting off my 10 best players in the NBA, I probably wouldn't include him, but the guy's averaging 24, 14, 4, 1, and 1 per 36 minutes this season. Just insane numbers. And a true shooting percentage over 57. He's been absolutely ridiculous. And like we both said now, when he's on the floor, Orlando is in fantastic shape. My guess is with all these lineups in the top 25 that Orlando has, they also must have a lot near the bottom because something's got to be dragging them down, and something has to have led to this sub 500 record that they have, because when they've got the starters, particularly Vucevic and Augustine on the floor, they're very, very good.
The splits on them are hysterical. So when Augustine plays without Vuce, Orlando has a 91.8 offensive rating. When Vuce plays without Augustine, they have a 101.8 offensive rating. When they play together, the Magic have a 113.2 offensive rating on the season. Jeez. That's some stuff.
Yeah.
Shout out Orlando. Sure. Or yeah. Shout out Vuce and Augustine.
Am I next? Yeah. 22. Darren Collison. So we're back to the Pacers. Tyreke Evans, Bojan Bogdanović, Thad Young, and Miles Turner. Only difference here is Tyreke Evans for Victor Oladipo, which is interesting because Evans individually has not been great.
He's been bad, you could say it.
Yeah, certainly not as good as he was with the Grizzlies last season, but there must be something to the infrastructure of that lineup, because they've played 522 possessions and they have an 11.7 net rating, which is in the 70th percentile. That gives them a lineup score of 61.07. I tend to think that it's the other four guys that are kind of lifting this up, not to discredit Tyreke Evans even further than we already have, but we've already talked about the defense of Young and Turner, and Bogdanović, I think, has shown a lot this season. He's going to be a really interesting free agency case this summer. I don't know what to add to this one beyond the fact that they're just, the infrastructure is strong enough in Indiana that they can replace their best player with a guy who just has not been great this season and still be quite good.
I'm just going to flat out say it too, is I would say you were spot on, just because if you look at the other four guys around him, and with Young and Turner's defense, it's like you said, the infrastructure is just there. And it says a lot about the Pacers that you can remove a player as important as Oladipo, but things are still going to, the engine is still going to keep running. A lineup distinction, of the top 25 lineups, this one has the highest opponent turnover percentage at 18.5. So they're forcing, and I mentioned this about their other lineup, they were forcing turnovers a ton. This lineup is forcing turnovers on 18.5% of their defensive possessions.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Yeah, that's crazy. That is crazy.
Moving on to number 21. This one is from the Raptors, and I guess it was just a little bit surprising to me because of the injuries that Fred VanVleet's dealt with, but Fred VanVleet, Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, Pascal Siakam, Serge Ibaka, they've played 379 possessions together, a net rating of 16.3 for a lineup score of 61.78. I guess I shouldn't. It's not surprising that the Raptors are here, and maybe this is a type of situation where, oh, you swap out Kyle Lowry for Fred VanVleet and it's fine. Perhaps that's really what it is. The defense of this group has not been great. The offense has been astounding, 124.3 offensive rating, effective field goal percentage close to 60, and they don't turn the ball over. 11% turnover rate, just about. I know a lot of people have talked about, not that the Raptors have underachieved, but they've looked like not as impressive as we think, because Kawhi Leonard, for long stretches, just exists so far outside Toronto's offense where it's, we really have to just give him the ball and go. But this, just like, think about how good the Raptors already are and to how that's not something that's going to get worse. Marc Gasol's already helped make things smoother, even when he's in the starting lineup. This is a team, and we've said it ad nauseum. They could really, I'm still bullish on them coming out of the East just because they seem like a squad that's going to peak in the postseason, given everything they've already done amid what's happened.
Yeah. And I don't think we've seen a ton of the Raptors at full strength. Cause Kawhi Leonard's been in and out of the lineup so much. Gasol's only been there for a little bit. Lowry's been in and out of the lineup so much. But this one being in the top 25 isn't super surprising to me. Like you said, Van Vliet has dealt with some injuries as well, but he was so good last season. So I'm not shocked to see him plugged in with all these other starters who've been good all year, and to see Toronto just kind of keep chugging along. I'm with you. I wouldn't be shocked if they came out of the East. My pick is still Milwaukee. But
what do you mean still? We both picked the Raptors.
Well, okay, it's still Milwaukee over the last, what, week? 2 or 3 months?
Yeah.
But yes, I did pick Toronto before the season started. So those top two teams are really good. And I wouldn't even be shocked if Philly made it out. I think we have three very real NBA Finals candidates in the East. I don't know if I have Boston there yet or not. They happen to be the next lineup. Number 20.
Is it weird to say, as you go into this lineup, that Boston, of the four teams in the East that we talk about as powers, is the least likely to make it to the NBA Finals, but I think that Philly actually poses the smallest threat to Golden State if they did make the NBA Finals? Is that an oxymoronic thing to say?
I don't think so. Kyrie Irving's been there. They have a lot of switchable guys defensively, which is what you want against the Warriors. Smart can guard multiple positions. Tatum theoretically can. Jaylen Brown can. Even Marcus Morris has some switchability. Horford's a great defensive center. So I can see them being a little bit more of a bugaboo for the Warriors. Do you agree with – would you have Philadelphia ahead of Boston if you're just looking at the East, though?
Yes, I would.
Okay.
Although Boston might, if they meet, might actually be a bad matchup Boston might be a bad matchup for Philly based off what we've seen. They're 1-3 against them this season, but different team really now when you look at now Harris and Butler. Butler's been there a while, but now you have that starting lineup. Will have some sample size under its belt. And if Joel Embiid's healthy and he actually found a way, the myth was in that last performance against Philly that he solved the Al Horford problem. He really didn't. He shot poorly against Al Horford, but he was moving the ball well when Horford was on him. And that's something that he's going to need to continue to do. Maybe that's two nuts and bolts right now, but that would be an interesting series.
Well, their starting lineup, or at least a lineup that has started a bunch of games for them this season, is number 20. Kyrie Irving, Marcus Smart, Jason Tatum, Marcus Morris, Al Horford, 1,057 possessions together. The only lineup we've done so far that had more was the Pacers starters at number 25, the Oladipo lineup. Their net rating is in the 58th percentile. So not like an overwhelmingly great net rating, but the fact that they've put together over 1,000 possessions together has helped them here. Their lineup score is 63.42. I don't know if the discussion on this lineup will be much different than a Celtics discussion generally. It just seems like they're good, but they should be better.
That seems fair.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what else to add. I mean, I think the Celtics have been talked about kind of ad nauseum this season. I don't know. It's just been sort of a drama fest for them. And I guess we'll see if they can pull it all together in the playoffs. There's still some Celtics fans are saying they'll be fine. I think the realists are a little bit more worried about all the chemistry issues that they've had. But they certainly have lineup combinations and talent that would suggest that they can make some noise.
They would, but we talk about all the improvement on an individual level when you look at Jaylen Brown, Gordon Hayward, just looking at the performance of Kyrie Irving, he hasn't really needed to improve. Jason Tatum's even been steadier after that start that had everyone worried. I know other guys have cooled off, Marcus Smart's three-point shooting, Marcus Morris's three-point shooting, but they don't ever seem to have everybody on all cylinders in the same game. And that's what was supposed to make this team so dangerous, is that they have so many weapons, but if they're not going to be coalesced into something together, that's That'll be a real problem. I'm genuinely concerned about them, but they have their road record is iffy. Their road record against teams above 500, I think it's like 4-12. It's around that area. That's not going to be great for the playoffs. They're still, it could happen, but I don't think even optimists can pretend that this balancing act is all of a sudden going to be a non-issue after it's been a problem for the entire year.
Yeah, I think you're right.
The 19th lineup, the honorable mention goes to a lineup that got bounced. Kyle Lowry, Danny Green, Kawhi Leonard, Pascal Siakam, and Jonas Valanciunas, who is now with the Grizzlies and kind of balling there. So
yeah.
The 19th place lineup now is Ben Simmons, J.J. Redick, Jimmy Butler, Tobias Harris, and Joel Embiid. They would be so much higher before I get to the numbers if they just had a bigger sample size under their belt. They've played 325 possessions. They have a net rating of 20.3 for a lineup score of 65.98. Just absolutely bonkers. You can see their offensive rating, but 125.6 offensive rating. That's just absolutely nuts. And their defensive rating is just 105.2. This is a lineup that can, when you look at Jimmy Butler, Embiid, and Ben Simmons, they can do so many things defensively where you almost, it makes Tobias Harris look good defensively because he's not, if Embiid's going to be on the primary big fine, but you have Simmons and Butler to move around against the point guard and then the second toughest scorer. So there are going to be a lot of times where he's defending the fourth best player on the court. And he's had some problems defensively dating back to his days with Milwaukee. And so that's a better assignments for him to carry. That is what scares me most about this team in the playoffs, in a good way. That this is what could really, I think, make them run away in any given series, is this lineup. If you shorten their rotation to 7 or 8 guys for this truncated period of time, you got to throw Boban in there, who can just pull up from 3 whenever he wants, apparently.
Yeah.
So this might, I would argue that if they had this lineup together for half the season, that it would have finished in the top 5.
Mm-hmm. In terms of raw talent, this lineup is crazy, and the numbers are backing it up in their short time together. The top 3 teams in the East and their starting lineups are just stacked this season. Which of the 3 do you think is best between Milwaukee, this one, and Toronto? And they're all healthy. So we've got Milwaukee's got Bledsoe, Brogdon, Middleton, Giannis, Lopez. I just drew a blank. Toronto's got Lowry, Green, Leonard, Siakam, and Ibaka. And then there's this one, Simmons, Redick, Butler, Harris, Embiid. All 3 of those lineups are like perfectly balanced. Talent at all 5 positions. These teams are just the Eastern Conference playoffs are going to be so fun to watch. I think you could make an argument that this is the best of those 3 starting 5s.
And I think I would too, because I don't even know. Toronto's been starting Gasol, and I don't even know any version of Ibaka Gasol. I don't even think that's Toronto's best lineup, period. I'm still Siakam at the 5, which hasn't been leaned on too heavily. So it would be, I think it might be clearly this lineup. Might not even be too big of a case for me, especially with now Milwaukee doesn't have Brogdon.
Yeah, if we take Brogdon out of the equation, that certainly changes things. I'm still not 100% sold on it being Philly, just because Milwaukee has the best player in any debate with Giannis. And I still think that everyone else in that lineup fits so well around him. But the top end talent in this lineup, again, it's crazy. You've got Ben Simmons, who's like a walking 18-8-8. Redick's one of the greatest 3-point shooters of all time. Jimmy Butler's this ridiculous closer for them. And I think a lot of the stuff about his role has been overblown. Even since Tobias Harris got there. I looked it up the other day, and maybe this isn't true still, but I think he was second in usage since the Tobias Harris trade. So he hasn't had to take a huge backseat. Harris is a great plug-and-play guy. A stretch 4, I think, is and kind of a playmaking 4, really, is something that makes a ton of sense next to Embiid. And then Embiid's a guy who a lot of people have in the MVP conversation. I'm not sure he'd be in my top 5, but I don't think it's crazy that a lot of people have him there. He's ridiculous. His raw numbers are like Shaq-esque. So this lineup 1 through 5 is just really balanced and really dangerous.
I'm just 100% there with you.
Life can be stressful, but getting life insurance shouldn't be. That's why there's Ethos. Ethos is a modern kind of life insurance that's super fast, incredibly affordable, and very uncomplicated. At GetEthos.com, there are no medical exams for policies covering under $1 million. No hours of paperwork. No meetings with pushy representatives. It only takes 10 minutes to apply, and you can rest assured knowing you've taken steps to protect your family. And in most cases with Ethos, you can have that peace of mind for less than a cup of coffee a day, with no hidden fees. Having life insurance can free you from stress. Getting life insurance shouldn't cause it. Discover how uncomplicated life insurance can be at Ethos. Get your free instant quote and submit your complete application in just minutes. Just go to GetEthos.com. That's E-T-H-O-S, GetEthos.com. GetEthos.com.
Denver Nuggets starters. Jamal Murray, Gary Harris, Will Barton, I almost said Patty Mills. I did this last year too. Paul Millsap. And Nikola Jokic, they've played 534 possessions, which is a really small sample. Denver has dealt with, not really small, but it's small if it's a starting lineup. Denver's dealt with a ton of injuries this season. 534 possessions for that group, a 12.4 net rating, which is in the 72nd percentile. Their lineup score of 66.22, again, it puts them 18th. When these five guys are on the floor, Denver really, really dangerous. This is another starting lineup that I think fits really well together, although I think the strength of Denver this season might be their bench. There are some numbers that say that Monty Morris is better than Jamal Murray. Malik Beasley's been right there with Gary Harris all year. I think really the driving force of this lineup this season is probably Millsap and Jokic. Jokic. So this is one that I'm not surprised to see there. And like the Sixers lineup, I think if they had played more together, if there hadn't been so many injuries, they'd be higher up on this list.
Yeah. This lineup shooting almost 40% from three on the season, and that's on 186 attempts too. And the defense has been good enough, probably just mid-end. Defensive rating of under 108. They probably would be better. Gary Harris is shooting like a zillion percent from three since the start of March, but he dealt with injuries. He wasn't playing well part of the season. You didn't have Will Barton for part of the season. This is another lineup that could have just benefited from more time together.
For sure. Yeah, they definitely would have been higher if they had avoided the injuries. And they probably would have played a little better within each individual possession if they'd been together more too.
They're going to be fascinating in the playoffs. I don't necessarily doubt them, but if they pull San Antonio or Oklahoma City in round one, there's a chance that they lose. And then there's going to be a lot of not just anti-Jokic campaigns, yeah, but just Nuggets are overrated campaigns if they lose.
I was going to say, I can see more hot takes for them losing in the first round than just about any team in the West. So for the sake of avoiding that, I hope they do win in the first round.
The next lineup, number 17, comes from one of their potential first-round opponents, the San Antonio Spurs. Again, this is number 17. Patty Mills, Marco Bellinelli, Rudy Gay, Davis Bertans, and Jakob Poeltl. They have played 186 possessions together, so not too many. Their net rating is 36.6 for a lineup score of 68.08. I'm sorry, I'm laughing because that's the most that's the second most ridiculous net rating on here. That Pistons lineup had a 47.4 net rating. I don't know if it's a lot. It surprises me. I'm just going to come out and say that it surprises me. True to San Antonio form, they haven't shot a ton of threes, but they're shooting almost 40% on them with this lineup. I'm a little bit, I'm a lot of bit surprised. I don't even know how to phrase this, that the defense has been as good with this group, a 90.3 defensive rating. I don't know that I would look at this and say, this is a really good defensive lineup. I wouldn't. Jakob Poeltl is good, and Rudy Gay, if you're going to use him at the three, I don't know. When you're going up against other bench heavy lineups, maybe that's the edge. And San Antonio's bench is life, death, taxes in San Antonio's bench, basically. As they're just a monster again this year. I think the last time I checked, they were second in point differential per 100 possessions, behind only the Indiana Pacers, which would make sense when we kind of look at some of their lineups that made it. So it's just absolutely absurd. And this is, again, this is a lineup to be so high. I know it's a small sample, but it legitimately catches me off guard. And San Antonio's bench has moved to third in point differential behind the Bucks now and the Pacers. So shout out to Milwaukee there. Is this a group that kind of caught you off guard that they ended up being this high?
Maybe this high is a little surprising, but I'm not shocked that the lineup is here. San Antonio's bench has been one of the staples of the Popovich era over the last few years. And this is a lineup that I think everybody knows how much I love shooting, and you've got shooting at four of the five positions. Like you said, they don't take a ton of threes, and I think that's sort of a philosophical thing in San Antonio, but they have a lot of guys who can hit threes in this lineup. Davis Bertans, especially, he's been fantastic this season, and I've wondered why he and Aldridge don't spend more time together. And speaking of that, that's the next lineup is a Bertans Aldridge combination. Unless you have anything else to say about that number 17, I'll just go ahead and move on to that one.
Yeah, because I have plenty to say about the lineup that's coming
out. Number 16 is also the Spurs. It's Derek White, who's been fantastic this season. There was a lot of doom and gloom, and I think understandably so, when DeJounte Murray went down at the start of this season, but the Spurs just plug along. It's such a machine at this point, and Derek White deserves a ton of credit for picking up the slack. Bryn Forbes, DeMar DeRozan, Davis Bertans, and LaMarcus Aldridge. 245 possessions, so still a pretty small sample size, but a 28.2 net rating, which is in the 97th percentile. That gives them a lineup score of 69.09. And there's actually, there's a little part of me that's kind of more surprised to see this one than the last one, because I haven't looked at this data in a while, but generally speaking throughout the season, at least up until maybe a month or so ago, when DeRozan and Aldridge were on the floor, it wasn't going great. But like I said, this is kind of a small sample lineup, and this is a lineup that has a bunch of shooting around Aldridge and DeRozan. Derek White's not like a, you know, knock your socks off shooter, but Forbes and Bertans are both great shooters, and White is good enough. I think the key with DeRozan and Aldridge is kind of like I was saying with the Drummond Griffin lineups. You got to put shooting around those two guys, because they are gonna take more long twos than really anybody in the league. So you gotta balance that somehow, and this lineup has certainly done that.
I'm going the other way on it, in the sense that I'm actually surprised that you said a bunch of shooting around Aldridge and DeRozan. Bertans good, Forbes good, White you said fine. This group is shooting 46% from three, 45.9% to be exact. Again, on a limited number of attempts, but when you don't have Aldridge or DeRozan shooting threes, you would think that that might make a lineup just a little bit more solvable. And to your point about Aldridge and Bertans playing together, they've logged 1,614 possessions together, and the Spurs are plus 8.4 points per 100 possessions in that time. Insane offensive rating.
I wonder how high that would be if we did lineup score for two-man lineups, because that's way more possessions than I thought they would have, 1,600.
I really wanted to see more of Bertans Gay, like take Aldridge off the court and go with that. That's something they haven't really gone to. Yeah. The defense is shaky, but that's just been the Spurs all year. So, but that's a good model. And I got Bertans and Forbes are really good shooters. And White, as you said, is good enough. That's still kind of caught me off guard. That's basically San Antonio's offense in a nutshell this season, though, because they've been a really good offensive team. But we're looking at back-to-back lineups with 126.9 offensive ratings from them, which is just simply incredible.
Yeah, for sure.
Number 15, from the Denver Nuggets, Jamal Murray, Malik Beasley, Torrey Craig, Paul Millsap, and Nikola Jokic. They've played 278 possessions together, net rating of 25.9 for a lineup score of 72. This isn't too surprising. I'm actually a little bit more shocked that I know Denver's dealt with a bunch of stuff this year, but I thought some of their lineups would have just bigger sample sizes for us to work with.
Yeah.
But this is a group where you look at the season that Malik Beasley has. His most improved player case has started to get a little bit louder of late. I don't know that he's in my top three in that category, but he's certainly been good for them this season. This is a group that's shooting over 46% from three. Torrey Craig can be a spacing liability, but he does bring just some nice defensive elements. Him and Millsap is a defensive combo. That's just a pairing that I'm very interested in. That to say nothing, though, the defense has been good with this group, but the offense has really just been absurd. 130.6 offensive rating. This placement doesn't surprise me for that. Again, I was more so taken aback that we don't have at least some bigger sample types to work with from Denver's team this year.
Yeah. The Gary Harris injury was a big one, obviously. I mean, and Will Barton was gone for a long time too. I know neither of those guys is in this lineup, but they have had to do a lot of mixing and matching this season. Really, the only constants were Murray and Jokic. Morris and Beasley were too, but they weren't expected to be that
right
coming into the season. So in terms of like the big name guys from Denver, it's been those two kind of carrying the way. And Paul Millsap has been really good this season too. I don't think people realize just how good he's been. As long as Millsap and Jokic are on the floor, Denver's been just really, really solid. Again, it'll be really interesting to see what happens to them in the first round. I think really the only gimme in the first round of the West is the Warriors. I guess if the clip, it depends on where the Clippers land. And maybe this is ridiculous of me to undersell the Clippers again after I've done it two or three times already this season. But I feel like that's maybe the only one we might consider an easy out is whoever the Clippers face. So if the Clippers wind up seventh and the Nuggets are second, that's a series the Nuggets should win. I mean, at least that's my opinion.
I would say yes. I would not. There's no great matchup in the West. Maybe the Rockets wouldn't care about playing the Clippers. The Nuggets' choices, I can't say, oh, I wouldn't want to play the Clippers if alternatives are like Oklahoma City and San Antonio.
Yeah.
That's a series they should win. It's just when we're not talking Warriors versus whoever, there's a path to basically anyone winning.
It would be Gallo's revenge if the Clippers took out the Nuggets.
Oh, Gallo. So good this year.
Yeah, he's amazing. But yeah, that's the Nuggets. Is it back to me, number 14?
Yes, sir.
This is Dennis Schroeder, Terrence Ferguson, Paul George, Jeremy Grant, and Steven Adams, a lineup that does not have Russell Westbrook.
Oh, boy.
Although... spoiler alert, he will make an appearance on the list at some point. This lineup has played 285 possessions. It has a 26.6 net rating, which is in the 96th percentile. Shout out to Paul George, as usual. He's been incredible this season. This is a lineup, like I said, that doesn't have Westbrook, and it's clearly doing just fine being led by Paul George. I think a guy that we've kind of talk plenty about, especially you, is Jeremy Grant. He's been awesome this season. Steven Adams smashes steaks. Have you seen that commercial?
Yes, I love that.
I love that commercial so much. This is a lineup that I think makes a ton of sense defensively. They got a lot of length and switchability with Ferguson, George, and Grant. Schroeder can give a little bit of the penetration that Russell Westbrook gives, so it kind of opens things up around the perimeter for George, and Steven Adams just does what Steven Adams does. He dominates the offensive boards, plays defense, sets good screens. This isn't a lineup that surprises me, even though Westbrook's not here.
I guess it doesn't surprise me because of all the other players involved, but I just haven't – there have been games where I've watched Dennis Schroeder and he gets hot. I haven't looked at him and thought he's been any sort of good this season. Maybe it's just the pressure that he continues to put on the defense in the half court type deal.
He's still kind of all over the place. I agree with you.
So it's not, again, when you look at everyone else who's involved, and I can't even remember who were they playing the other night. They came from behind to win, and Jeremy Grant just hit a bunch of just big shots, including a three. He's just come such a long way offensively, and if he's going to be an offensive asset, considering what he can do defensively, he like teleports to the rim. If Steven Adams ever has to get pulled away from it, he's just there. It's incredible to watch. So once more, with all the other players involved, this is a lineup that I think it's easy to talk yourself into, but I'm looking, Dennis Schroeder being involved in this is still a little disarming to me.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, I just looked him up while we were talking. He is a -3.3 box plus minus this season, which is
shooting like -3% from deep or something like that.
But -3% is an upgrade from Westbrook's 3-point percentage, I think. So
Westbrook's been good though from three over the past couple weeks.
Yeah, and I'm actually looking at Schroeder again, and his 3-point percentage is actually a little better than I would have thought too. It's 33.7, which is below average.
I never would have guessed that. I would have said sub 31 at least.
Like his raw numbers are not bad. He's playing 29 minutes, 15.5 points, 4.2 assists. That's 19 points and 5 assists per 36. His true shooting percentage is not great. That's well below average. That's probably what's dragging him down. He's at 50.4 for true shooting percentage. But yeah, I think, you know, the numbers are one thing, but I think having a guy who, like you mentioned at one point, he just kind of puts pressure on the inside. He can get to the rim pretty much at will, and that forces defenses to collapse at least a little bit. And you don't have to give Paul George a ton of space on the perimeter to do damage this season. I mean, he's just been this recent sort of cold stretch for him notwithstanding, he's just been ridiculous all year.
That brings us to our number 13 lineup. DJ Augustine, Evan Fournier, Aaron Gordon, Jonathan Isaac, and Nikola Vucevic. Just the one sub out here, I think, is Isaac for Ross from the previous lineup that they have. Mm-hmm. They've played 1,538 possessions. They have a net rating of 5.4, so they're benefiting here from volume a lot. For a lineup score of 83.05. The offensive rating on this group is 109.6. The defensive rating is 104.1. They're just solid all around. The thing to really watch for them, Jonathan Isaac is this swing piece right now. For what he's doing, he's always been kind of pesky on defense, but for what he's done on offense, since their win on February 7th over the Minnesota Timberwolves, that's a span of 22 games. He is averaging 12 points, 5.7 rebounds, 1.5 blocks, and slashing 46%, 39.4%, and 74.3%. If you're going to get Jonathan Isaac to shoot 39-plus percent on more than 5 attempts per 36 minutes, that's huge. And this is a team that they're not going to do damage in the playoffs if they make it, but he's been really big and is a prospect that I think has quietly come along.
Yeah, those are like Jeremy Grant numbers.
Yeah.
For Jonathan Isaac, if they suddenly have their Jeremy Grant.
He's hit a couple pull-up threes when I've seen him, though, and that's something that Grant's game, it doesn't need to have when you look at who's around him. And that's really what Orlando kind of needs. If he's just a threat off the dribble, the Magic's trajectory changes a great deal.
For sure. Before this season started, and maybe even before they drafted Mo Bamba, I was really interested in the 4-5 combo of Gordon and Isaac. I'm still interested in that, especially if Isaac is going to develop into a high 30s 3-point shooter. This is not terribly related, but I for some reason thought about it while you were talking. Are they going to re-sign Vucevic this summer? I mean, he has been ridiculously good for them this season. But there is some evidence that would say maybe we should steer into younger guys, a little bit of a rebuild. What's our ceiling with Vucevic? I think they clearly get significantly worse as soon as he leaves. But would it be better for them in the long run if they committed more to Isaac, Bamba, Gordon? I'm not as sold on that as I was before the season because Bamba wasn't quite as good as I thought he would be. Like I said, I'm still really interested in the Gordon-Isaac pairing, but at this point, I wouldn't be shocked to see them re-sign Vucevic and just keep trying.
They're kind of obligated to re-sign him, I would think, unless his value on the open market is out of control. I don't see that happening, though, because which teams have cap space and need a center? You start to run out of runway.
Lots of Mavericks people are very interested.
I have no desire to pay big money to Kristaps Porzingis and Nikola Vucevic.
And I think that's fair. A really intriguing 4-5 combo to me for them is Luka and Porzingis. and you obviously complicate that if you put Vucevic in the mix. I think Porzingis can play the four, but I prefer him at the five.
What about, I'm kind of talking myself out of it, but people who think, I saw comments on some of your catch-all ranking tweets that said Vucevic is a terrible defender, doesn't play defense. He does play defense. He's a pretty good rim protector. What if you put him in Atlanta with John Collins? That defense is probably still too bad.
That would be interesting. But that's another guy that I would I can see him playing the four, but I would prefer Collins at the five.
I don't know if he's ever going to be able to defensively handle the five. That being said, I don't know if he's ever going to be able to defensively handle the four. So,
yeah, that's true. And it's like, it's such a ready-made Steve Nash and Amari Stoudemire comparison. If you've got Young at the one and Collins at the five, and maybe that's just nostalgia talking, but and I think I just have like a predisposition for undersized or technically undersized fives. Like he's obviously big enough.
I mean, he's a trampoline. To play
five, but yeah. It's interesting. We talked about Bojan Bogdanović having an interesting free agency case this summer, but Vucevic certainly will too.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what his market ends up being. We are on to number 12. Here's the honorable mention of the lineup that got bounced: Ben Simmons, JJ Redick, Jimmy Butler, Wilson Chandler, and Joel Embiid. The number 12 lineup is actually, though, from Milwaukee: Eric Bledsoe, Malcolm Brogdon, Chris Middleton, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Brooke Lopez. 1,336 possessions together. They have a 6.3 net rating for a lineup score of 84.17. No surprise them being here. I might have expected them to be even higher. And I'm almost shocked that they're – this sounds stupid to say. They have an offensive rating of 112.6. And I'm like perturbed that that's not higher. Just when you look at all that talent that's on there and how Brogdon's been shooting. The group, though, and this caught me. This I didn't see coming. That five-man lineup is shooting 34.4% from three. That is low. I know Brooke Lopez has had he's been bombing away and has had his just off nights. But you look at, and I know Giannis Antetokounmpo isn't a 3-point shooter, but he shot better this season overall relative to some of his other years. I was, again, solid offensive rating at just under 113. I thought it would have been higher. Maybe it's just that's too heavy the eye test coming out at me, because that lineup, I don't want to say it seems unguardable, but it just unlocks everything if you're going to have Brooke Lopez chucking away from 26 feet.
Yeah, this is that starting lineup I was talking about earlier. I think one of the things that drags their numbers down a little bit is they've played a lot together. I think in this entire list, there's I see three lineups in the entire top 25 who've logged more possessions than this squad. And I think when you've played that much together, it's just natural for your numbers to look a little bit more mortal. Because there's going to be more ups and downs if you've played a ton together. And the 3-point percentage isn't terribly shocking to me either. Giannis was terrible from three for the first few months of the season. Bledsoe, I can't imagine I'm looking him up now. I would guess he's below average for the season. Yeah, he's 32.5% from three.
Middleton's also struggled in Budenholzer's offense at times.
Yeah, but I think you have the threat. You have enough of a threat of shooting, especially, unfortunately, Brogdon's hurt. I think he'll probably reappear at some point in the playoffs. But you have to – Bledsoe's done enough as a shooter that you at least have to respect him out there. Brogdon's obviously fantastic. Middleton, same thing. Like, you have to be out there. And then Lopez, he just changes the dimensions of the court. The way that he'll just catapult up a three from 5 or 6 feet beyond the line, and there's a chance of it going in, and you have to guard the center that far from the basket. It was just brilliant of the Bucks front office and Mike Budenholzer to structure the lineup and the offense the way that they did. And it's a big part of why Giannis has been so good this season. They just put him in the ideal situation for his skill set. And this lineup is just so well tailored to what he does. I think it was on the Howard Beck, Zach Loeb podcast from yesterday or 2 days ago. Did you hear that one where they were talking about the Giannis versus Harden MVP debate?
No, it's on my podcast backlog, which is another complaint I have. My podcast backlog goes from 0 to 100 in like a day.
Yeah, that happens to me too. But they were saying that some people think that Harden has a better case for MVP because you put him in just about any situation and he's going to produce huge numbers. Whereas Giannis has everything just sort of tailor-made for him by the front office and the coaching staff. And I think there's maybe a kernel of truth to that, but I think you could probably say the same thing about Giannis. You put him just about anywhere and he's going to elevate everyone around him. And Harden has certainly benefited from the Mike D'Antoni pairing. I mean, his numbers weren't as astronomical as they were before. And they went all in on what they did with Morey and D'Antoni. But I don't think that should discredit Giannis. But yes, Milwaukee was smart to put players that fit him around him.
Okay. Here's my qualms with that. Brook Lopez is like the biggest addition for them, and Ersan Ilyasova. And it's Mike Budenholzer has gotten some minutes out of guys who are already on the bench for them, basically. I'm not going to sit here and say that Houston isn't tailored for James Harden. Mike D'Antoni compromised his entire offensive philosophy for James Harden. And so I'm not trying to take away from these other players. I hate how these MVP debates, and I'm obviously not putting this on you, I hate how it becomes you can't pick the other guy without cutting down the runner-up.
Yeah.
It's just, it's a hard decision, and either these guys are going to put up numbers wherever they go. If you're trying to make the case that who would be better as plug and play, it has to be Harden just because he's going to be the better shooter.
Mm-hmm. But I think that's fair.
That's where I would fall on that. This next lineup that you're going to read off is proof that I was lying before.
I don't remember the lie, but the lineup is Damian Lillard, CJ McCollum, Jake Layman, Al Farouq Aminu, and Yusuf Nurkic. They've played 767 possessions. They have a net rating of 11.2, which gives them a lineup score of 85.9. This is another one that's not super surprising, but it's also kind of sad, as we talked about at the top of the podcast. Nurkic is obviously done for the rest of the postseason, and it's going to be hard to replicate everything that he did for them.
And my lie was that the Blazers wouldn't be appearing on part one. They'd be in part two.
Oh, okay.
No, it's not really surprising at all. Their defense isn't great. This lineup is fine. I think it's in like the 70th percentile of defense, which is just for someone like me who has pointed out in the past that I thought that Nurkic was benefiting defensively off of Terry Stotts's schemes. That's some nice little crow for me to eat right there. But it's not surprising at all when you look at this roster has benefited from continuity. Jake Layman has played well this year, better than I think. I don't know that did anyone pick him as like this guy that was not only going to be a semi-pivotal part of the rotation, but his three-point percentage has plummeted, but he's shooting 65.4% on twos. So having him just really helps out. And then Damian Lillard is just the straw that stirs this drink for them. He's never played better basketball, and they haven't really – I know a guy like Layman, and if you want to talk to the way that Nurkic has been playing, it's really helped his playmaking where he can pass out of double teams. You know the ball's going somewhere. It's not like they've improved the personnel around him or changed it up a great deal to where it's made that easier. So he's really just been – just diversifying his attack and making better decisions has been a huge part of where – the Blazers are today. And my last point, and maybe it's more of a musing on this lineup, I might put Al Farouq Aminu on a defensive team, an all defense team. The Blazers offense unspectacular, but he's so good.
Yeah. Another guy who can guard all over the floor. You know what's surprising to me? I should have known this about Jake Layman, but I don't think I fully realized how bouncy he is. He just kind of explodes off the floor, and I just was, for the heck of it, looked up dunks by Blazers this year. Number one is Nurkic, number two is Harkless, and number three is Jake Layman. He's got 48 dunks this year. I wouldn't be surprised if that's even more than, like, Donovan Mitchell. he is way more athletic than I realized for some reason. Maybe that's some preconceived notion or something. This lineup isn't – another one that's not super shocking to see, and it's just unfortunate that we won't get to see it in the postseason. There's going to be some heavy lifting that Cantor or Zach Collins or maybe even Myers Leonard might have to do in the playoffs for Portland to make much noise. that takes us, we've done 25 through 11, so there's obviously 10 left, but we're going to save the top 10 for you guys for another episode. So you have that to look forward to. As always, you can hit us up on Twitter, talk to us about anything that we mentioned in this episode or anything we didn't mention in this episode. Dan is at Dan Favale, F-A-V-A-L-E. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. As always, we also encourage you to go look at Blue Wire Pods on Twitter. Rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast if you haven't done those things already. If you have, share it with your friends and family. They will thoroughly and sincerely appreciate that, and they will appreciate you for sharing such a wonderful podcast with them. And until next time, we leave you with the shout out to Ben Oudry and Kyle Anderson.